Tantor Audio presents Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana by William M. Leogrand and Peter Kornbluh. Narrated by Robertson Dean. Introduction. Rebuilding Bridges. Our relations are like a bridge in wartime. I'm not going to talk about who blew it up. I think it was you who blew it up. The war has ended. And now we are reconstructing the bridge, brick by brick, 90 miles from Key West to Baradero Beach. It is not a bridge that can be reconstructed easily, as fast as it was destroyed. It takes a long time. If both parties reconstruct their part of the bridge, we can shake hands without winners or losers. Raul Castro to Senators George McGovern and James Averesk, April 8, 1977. In early April of 1963, during talks in Havana over the release of Americans being held in Cuban jails as spies, Fidel Castro first broached his interest in improving relations with the United States. If any relations were to commence between the U.S. and Cuba, Castro asked U.S. negotiator James Donovan, how would it come about, and what would be involved? Sent to Cuba in the fall of 1962 by President John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert to undertake the first real negotiations with Cuba's revolutionary regime, Donovan had secured the freedom of more than 1,000 members of the CIA-led exile brigade that Castro's forces had defeated at the Bay of Pigs. In addition to the prisoners, Donovan also secured Castro's confidence. Through trips in January, March, and April 1963, he built on that confidence to negotiate the freedom of several dozen U.S. citizens detained after the revolution. In the respectful nature of their talks, Castro found the first trusted U.S. representative with whom he could seriously discuss how Havana and Washington might move toward restoring civility and normalcy in the dark wake of the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. In view of the past history on both sides here, the problem of how to inaugurate any relations was a very difficult one, Castro observed. So I said, now, do you know how porcupines make love? Donovan remembered responding. And he said, no. And I said, well, the answer is, very carefully. And that is how you and the U.S. would have to get into this. As Donovan pursued his shuttle diplomacy during the spring of 1963, some Kennedy administration officials sought to use his special relationship with Castro to begin a dialogue toward ending hostilities with Cuba. Within the CIA, however, others saw a different opportunity, an opportunity to use the negotiations and the negotiator to assassinate Fidel Castro. Knowing that Donovan planned to bring a scuba diving suit as a confidence-building gift for the Cuban leader, members of the covert Executive Action Unit developed a plot to contaminate the snorkel with tubercle bacillus and poison the wetsuit with a fungus. They tried to use him as the instrument, the lawyer who was negotiating the liberation of the Playa Giron prisoners, Castro exclaimed years later. Only the intervention of Donovan's CIA handlers, Milan Miskovsky and Frank DeRosa, prevented him from becoming an unwitting would-be assassin. The CIA's infamous assassination plots, exploding conch shells, poison pens, poison pills, sniper rifles, toxic cigars, are the stuff of legend in the history of U.S. policy toward the Cuban Revolution. Washington's efforts to roll back the revolution through exile paramilitary attacks, covert action, overt economic embargo, and contemporary democracy promotion programs have dominated and defined more than a half-century of U.S.-Cuban relations. What Henry Kissinger characterized as the perpetual antagonism between Washington and Havana remains among the most entrenched and enduring conflicts in the history of U.S. foreign policy. The Untold Story. There is, however, another side to the history of U.S.-Cuban relations, far less known but more relevant today: the bilateral efforts at dialogue, rapprochement, and reconciliation. Every president since Eisenhower has engaged in some form of dialogue with Castro and his representatives. Some talks have been tightly circumscribed, dealing only with specific, narrow issues of mutual interest, such as immigration, air piracy, and drug interdiction. Others have been wide-ranging, engaging the full panoply of issues at stake between the two sides. Some episodes of dialogue produced tangible agreements, formal and informal. Others sputtered to a halt with no discernible result. But every U.S. president, Democrat and Republican alike, has seen some advantage in talking to Cuba. Indeed, both Democratic and Republican administrations have engaged in little-known efforts to arrive at a modus vivendi with the Cuban Revolution. After authorizing a paramilitary invasion to overthrow Castro by force and implementing a full trade embargo to cripple the Cuban economy, John F. Kennedy ordered his aides to start thinking along more flexible lines in negotiating a state of peaceful coexistence with Castro. During Gerald Ford's presidency, Henry Kissinger directed his aides to deal straight with Castro and negotiate improved relations like a big guy, not like a shyster. Jimmy Carter actually signed a presidential decision directive to achieve normalization of our relations with Cuba through direct and confidential talks. Given the domestic political sensitivity surrounding any hint of better relations with Havana, these talks, and many other contacts with Cuba, have often been conducted through secret back-channel diplomacy. To maintain plausible deniability, U.S. presidents have turned to third countries, among them Mexico, Spain, Britain, and Brazil, as hosts and facilitators. To limit the political risk of direct contact, Washington and Havana have developed creative clandestine methods of communication, deploying famous literary figures, journalists, politicians, businessmen, and even a former president of the United States as interlocutors. When face-to-face talks have been necessary, Cuban and U.S. officials have met furtively in foreign cities such as Paris, Cuernavaca, and Toronto, or in private homes, crowded cafeterias, prominent hotels, and even on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. On several occasions, White House and State Department officials have secretly traveled to Havana to negotiate face-to-face with Fidel Castro. Not surprisingly, this rich history of U.S. back-channel diplomacy with Cuba has been shrouded in secrecy, buried in thousands of classified files that record the internal debates, meetings, agendas, negotiations, arguments, and agreements that have transpired over more than half a century. In the absence of an accessible historical record, scholarship and analysis on U.S.-Cuban relations has largely focused on the more prominent and visible history of antagonism, skewing the historical debate over whether better ties were possible or even desirable. The dearth of evidence on the many efforts to find common ground has empowered the anti-dialogueros, as one U.S. official called them, to cast serious diplomacy with Cuba as an oxymoron at best, a heresy at worst. Long after the end of the Cold War, talking with Cuba remained a delicate and controversial political proposition, even as the benefits have become increasingly obvious to both countries. Back Channel to Cuba. This book presents a comprehensive chronicle of the history of dialogue between the United States and Cuba since 1959. The pages that follow are an attempt to assess this historical record of negotiations, both secret and open, at a time when that record is especially pertinent to the political discourse over U.S. relations with Cuba. Both Barack Obama and Raúl Castro publicly declared their desire to move beyond the past half-century's legacy of hostility. Both Washington and Havana appeared to realize that international, national, and mutual interests would be advanced by a successful negotiation of normal bilateral ties. But as the history of dialogue shows, having the intention to improve relations and actually accomplishing it are two different things. Between intention and realization lies a long road of negotiation on complex problems. But the past holds lessons for contemporary policymakers on how to navigate that road. How have previous talks evolved between Washington and Havana? Why have some succeeded and others failed? What does this history tell policymakers, scholars, and concerned citizens about the potential for rapprochement between two nations that have been intimate enemies for more than half a century? These are among the key questions explored in this volume. To reconstruct this history, we have spent more than a decade unearthing the classified files through the Freedom of Information Act, mandatory declassification review, and archival research on multiple episodes of dialogue between Washington and Havana. These include the State Department's file Efforts at Negotiation with Cuba from the Eisenhower Administration, contacts with Cuban leaders, records compiled during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, the special activities file kept by Henry Kissinger's office on his top-secret attempt to negotiate normal relations, the Carter administration's roadmap to normalization and memoranda of conversations with Fidel Castro himself, and internal papers from the Clinton White House on engagement with Havana. These records, along with hundreds of others, shed new light on the policies, strategies, and interplay of both governments in their pursuit of better relations. With the documents in hand, we interviewed a broad array of the surviving policymakers and negotiators who drafted the documents and participated in talks, Fidel Castro and former President Jimmy Carter among them, along with the intermediaries who carried messages back and forth between Washington and Havana. Their firsthand accounts bring the documentary record to life, adding a critical human dimension to the story. Indeed, in many ways, this book chronicles the tenacious efforts of key official and non-official policy actors who, for more than 50 years, challenged the national security managers in successive administrations to consider the options of dialogue and engagement over the dominant U.S. approach of antagonism and estrangement. The perennial conflict between U.S. officials who advocated punishing Cuba to force its compliance and those who argued for diplomacy is a recurrent theme of this history. Every administration has had its hawks and doves on Cuba. How they interacted depended, to some degree, on the domestic and international circumstances of the time. At every juncture, efforts at dialogue, and their success or failure, were a product not only of the state of relations between Washington and Havana, but also of the balance of domestic political forces in the two capitals. To the extent possible, given space limitations, this book provides and analyzes the political circumstances and context within which bilateral talks took place. Although Fidel Castro's preeminence and dominance meant that policymaking in Havana was less fractious than it was in Washington, the pages that follow reveal that there were debates on the Cuban side as well. Cuban policy was hardly static. Fidel's attitude toward the United States evolved over time. Raúl Castro's succession introduced yet another factor, his determination to resolve the revolution's critical outstanding problems, among them relations with the United States, before passing the baton to the next generation of Cuban leaders. For more than half a century, the history of talks has been inextricably intertwined with and overshadowed by the more infamous history of acrimony and distrust in U.S.-Cuban relations. Back Channel to Cuba aspires to give the history of dialogue its due. This history provides strong evidence that, despite proceeding very carefully, both the United States and Cuba have long recognized that negotiation and cooperation offer potential benefits over a perpetual state of antagonism and aggression. Our interest is in getting the Cuban issue behind us, not in prolonging it indefinitely. One secret memo written almost 30 years ago to Henry Kissinger stated clearly, "Our relations are like a bridge in wartime," Raúl Castro observed shortly thereafter, describing the damage done by years of hostility. "It is not a bridge that can be reconstructed easily, as fast as it was destroyed. It takes a long time. If both parties reconstruct their part of the bridge, we can shake hands without winners or losers." 1. Eisenhower. Patience and Forbearance. During the first 9 months of my stay in Cuba, I did my best to convince Castro and many of his personal advisors of our good intentions. It was not until November of 1959 that I was finally convinced that we could not expect to reach any sort of understanding with him. But even after that, I was in favor of maintaining all possible contacts and exploring all possibilities of negotiation. Ambassador Philip Bonsall, letter to Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., November 13, 1962. Fidel Castro, in his olive-green fatigues, and Acting Secretary of State Christian A. Herter, in his three-piece suit and bow tie, made an incongruous couple. Castro, on his first trip to the United States since the triumph of the Revolution, met Herter for lunch in the Pan American room of Washington's luxurious Statler Hilton Hotel on April 16, 1959. Sitting in front of a large primitive art mural of a Latin American peasant tilling the soil, they engaged in animated conversation. When Castro pulled out a cigar, Herter lit it for him. Fidel's mood was buoyant. Just 4 months earlier, he had led an army of bearded guerrillas in the Sierra Maestra of eastern Cuba. Now, he was Cuba's new prime minister, having lunch with one of the most powerful officials in the United States government. Events had moved fast in those intervening weeks, certainly faster than Washington had anticipated. Eager to tell Cuba's story, and certain he could sway U.S. opinion by the force of his own conviction, Fidel told Herter of his plans for Cuba and admitted his frustration at his own lack of experience in the practical affairs of governing. He made a plea for patience while he worked to restore order in the aftermath of the revolution. Herter, more than twice Fidel's age, was a seasoned diplomat intent on taking Castro's measure and persuading him that good relations with the United States were in Cuba's best interests. What impressed Herter most was Castro's youthful immaturity. He reported to Eisenhower that he was sorry the president had not had a chance to meet Castro, who was a most interesting individual, but very much like a child in many ways. One of the most startling sights, he added, was Castro's 8 wild-eyed armed bodyguards who swept into the Pan-American room and sat down on the floor to wait while the official delegations ate lunch. The patrician Herter was not comfortable with the disarray of revolutionary change, and in this he would prove to be a faithful representative of his government. During lunch, William Wieland, director of the Office of Caribbean and Mexican Affairs, was introduced to Castro as the State Department official in charge of Cuban affairs, to which Fidel replied, "And I thought I was in charge of Cuban affairs." It was a clever joke, but fraught with symbolism. For half a century, a parade of U.S. presidents and their representatives had acted as if the United States was in charge of Cuban affairs. Fidel, with a smile, was serving notice that this, too, was about to change. Prologue to Revolution. Herter's lunch with Castro displayed in microcosm some recurring features of the many dialogues to come between U.S. and Cuban officials. Talks were often guarded, undertaken with a certain reticence because neither side trusted the other's intentions. Sometimes those suspicions were enough in themselves to derail the process. On the U.S. side, positions often reflected an arrogance born of great power hubris and a presumption that U.S. priorities should naturally take precedence over Cuba's. On the Cuban side, positions often reflected a stubborn pride, born of a half-century of domination, that made resistance to U.S. demands a virtue in its own right. 100 years of tumultuous relations between the two countries weighed heavily on both. During the 19th century, Washington openly coveted Cuba and saw its acquisition as inevitable. As John Quincy Adams famously said in 1823, "If an apple severed by its native tree cannot choose but fall to the ground, Cuba can gravitate only towards the North American Union." Although Cuba remained a Spanish possession, its economy and social life were already gravitating toward the United States. Economic ties produced a free flow of people in both directions, carrying with them the artifacts and values of their respective cultures. The culture and national identity of modern Cuba were shaped by this encounter with the United States. "The North American presence was ubiquitous, expanding in all directions at once," wrote historian Luis Perez, Jr. "At every point that this presence made contact with the prevailing order of Cuban life, almost everywhere, it challenged, it contested, it changed." This pervasive U.S. influence eroded Spanish colonial control and laid the cultural foundation for Cuba's independence movement. But it also posed a threat to Cuba's aspiration to become a free and independent country, as José Martí, the father of Cuban independence, foresaw. Shortly before riding into battle against the Spanish and to his death, Martí wrote, "Every day now I am in danger of giving my life for my country and my duty in order to prevent, by the timely independence of Cuba, the United States from extending its hold across the Antilles and falling with all the greater force on the lands of our America. All I have done up to now and all I will do is for that." In 1898, the United States intervened in Cuba's 3-year-old War of Independence, quickly defeated the Spanish, and occupied the island until 1902. As the price of independence, Cubans were forced to accept the Platt Amendment to their constitution. It gave the United States the right to intervene in Cuba to protect its independence, required Cuba to sell or lease land to the United States for naval bases, the origin of Guantanamo Naval Station, and prohibited Cuba from signing treaties with any other foreign governments to provide them with bases. Not surprisingly, the Platt Amendment was anathema to Cuban nationalists. Over the next two decades, U.S. troops returned to Cuba several times to halt outbreaks of political violence. Treaties and laws promulgated by the U.S. military governors gave U.S. businesses unmatched advantages in the Cuban market, and U.S. investment flowed freely. By the 1930s, U.S. interests owned most of the sugar industry, the heart of the Cuban economy, most of the tobacco industry, the banks, and public utilities. The power and influence of U.S. investors over Cuba's economy came to rival the power and influence of U.S. diplomats over its political affairs. Cuba's politics during the early decades of the century were marked by corruption, both financial and electoral. In 1933, Gerardo Machado's dictatorship was overthrown by a coalition of university students, organized labor, and non-commissioned military officers, which established a revolutionary government promising social reform. Worried that these progressives threatened U.S. interests, Washington conspired with the head of the armed forces, Fulgencio Batista, to engineer a coup just 3 months after the revolutionaries took office. With U.S. support, Batista ruled Cuba, either directly or indirectly, until 1944, when, after a reasonably free election, he turned power over to the opposition. But in 1952, Batista emerged from retirement and organized a military coup to return himself to power. The United States was not deeply troubled by Batista's seizure of power, suspension of constitutional rule, or flagrant corruption, including deals with the mafia. He had long been a faithful ally, siding with Washington internationally and safeguarding U.S. interests. Even as opposition to Batista mounted and police repression grew more brutal, Washington continued to support him. Ambassador Arthur Gardner, a political appointee, was such an ostentatious booster that even Batista was embarrassed by the slavishness of his praise. "I'm glad Ambassador Gardner approves of my government," Batista quipped, "but I wish he wouldn't talk about it so much." Fidel Castro, then a young lawyer, emerged as the leader of the opposition by organizing an audacious but unsuccessful assault on the Army's Moncada barracks in Santiago, Cuba, on July 26, 1953, the date for which his revolutionary movement would later be named. Defending himself during his trial for sedition, Castro argued eloquently that insurrection against Batista's unconstitutional regime was justified, famously closing with the words, "Condemn me, it does not matter. History will absolve me." Distributed nationwide in pamphlet form, the speech made him a national figure. Inspired by the writings of José Martí, Fidel Castro was a fervent nationalist. He could quote key passages from Martí's work from memory. Having grown up in rural Cuba, where poverty was stark, he had a visceral understanding of the deep inequality of Cuba's social order and an instinctive sympathy for the poor. Castro's original political program was radically reformist, calling for social programs to fight poverty, agrarian reform, and greater Cuban autonomy from U.S. influence. Washington saw Castro as a dangerous radical. As the revolutionary movement gathered force, the Eisenhower administration was torn between its instinct to support the reliable but increasingly unpopular Batista and the dawning realization that Batista could not survive. But efforts to distance the United States from the tottering regime were ineffectual. To many Cubans, the long-standing ties between Batista and the United States made it impossible for Washington to escape its role as Batista's patron. As Batista's armed forces collapsed in the final months of 1958, Washington tried to engineer a transition, replacing Batista with military officers willing to continue the fight against Castro's rebel army. The maneuver failed. On January 1, 1959, Batista fled into exile. Fidel Castro's forces occupied the eastern city of Santiago, and a day later, rebel troops, led by Ernesto Che Guevara, entered the city of Havana. Despite Washington's desperate last-minute maneuvers, the revolution had triumphed. Cubans were full of hope and anticipation at the fall of the dictator, and Washington was full of trepidation about the shape of things to come. How should the United States deal with this brash young band of revolutionaries and the potential challenge to U.S. hegemony they represented, not just in our own backyard, but right on the back porch? How would Cuba's new leaders deal with the Colossus of the North, whose dominance they resented, but on whom Cuba remained deeply dependent? Could the two sides reach a modus vivendi? Would they want to? The soft glove approach. Ambassador Philip W. Bonsall arrived in Havana on February 19, 1959, determined to break the mold of previous U.S. ambassadors who so often acted like proconsuls. For the next 20 months, Bonsall would work tirelessly to build a constructive relationship with Cuba's new revolutionary government, keeping open the channels for negotiation as long as he could, while struggling against obstacles in Washington as well as Havana. The relationship between Cuba and the United States was changing radically as a result of the revolution. The paternalism that had marked relations since 1898 had become an anachronism, but Bonsall was convinced that he could navigate the transition to a new, more equal relationship by engaging Cuba's revolutionary leaders in dialogue. Bonsall came well equipped for the challenge. Unlike his two predecessors, political appointees Arthur Gardner and Earl E.T. Smith, Bonsall was a professional Foreign Service officer who had lived in Latin America most of his adult life. Patrician in bearing, gentlemanly in demeanor, Bonsall had a reputation as a liberal reformer. He disdained as short-sighted Washington's proclivity to tolerate dictators who claimed ideological kinship with the United States. He favored support for social change, even when it infringed on the interests of U.S. investors. As ambassador to Colombia, Bonsall's meetings with Democratic opponents of General Gustavo Rojas Pinilla so angered the dictator that Bonsall had to be recalled. From there he was sent to Bolivia, where his policy of constructive engagement helped steer a revolutionary government toward moderation. Good relations, Bonsall believed, would be grounded in the economic mutuality of interest between Cuba and the United States. Rhetoric and youthful exuberance aside, Castro and his barbudos, bearded guerrillas, would eventually realize that economic ties between the two countries were so intricate that neither would be well served by rupturing them. This, in turn, would exercise a stabilizing and moderating influence on the new government. Official Washington distrusted Fidel and his rebel army commanders, however. "I was impressed by the reserve with which Castro was viewed," Bonsall wrote of his State Department colleagues. "They accepted the Cuban reality as it then appeared and were determined to develop productive relations with the new government, but they had no enthusiasm for Castro. U.S. officials suspected that Castro was dangerously radical, even if he was not a communist. His nationalism and commitment to social change were bound to conflict with U.S. interests on the island, where U.S. investors had more than $1 billion in assets." In April 1959, the Latin American Bureau of the State Department held a Caribbean Chiefs of Mission Conference in San Salvador to brief U.S. ambassadors on Cuba policy. Bonsall held center stage, arguing that Castro's policies were reformist, nationalistic, and somewhat socialistic and neutralist, but nevertheless that the trajectory of the regime was malleable. Moreover, Bonsall pointed out to skeptical colleagues, the revolution was a fait accompli. Castro was firmly in power, the quintessential charismatic leader, so popular that everyone called him Fidel, even his enemies. Polls showed backing for the new government exceeding 90%. Washington had little choice but to deal with Castro, so Bonsall argued for a policy of patience and forbearance. In private, Bonsall told his colleagues that Cuba needed a revolution, and Castro was not as bad as he seemed. If Washington followed a soft-glove approach, Bonsall was confident he could handle Castro. The rebels of Castro's 26th of July movement distrusted the United States because of its dominance of the Cuban economy, its history of interfering in Cuban politics, its friendship with Batista, and its 11th-hour maneuvers to keep Castro from coming to power. Before Bonsall even landed in Havana, relations were marred by vocal criticism in the U.S. press and Congress over summary trials and executions of several hundred police and military officials from the old regime, what Senator Wayne Morris, Democrat of Oregon, called the bloodbath in Cuba. Cubans were flabbergasted at this sudden eruption of concern for human rights. There had been no comparable outcry during Batista's reign of terror, which took the lives of thousands. "The Americans seemed to be defending their old friends," recalled Carlos Franqui, editor of the daily newspaper Revolución. All across the island, clandestine cemeteries were being exhumed, revealing the gruesome handiwork of Batista's police. Hardly a Cuban does not have a relative.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?